Welcome to Critical Readings, episode 29 for the 13th of January, 2020. I'm Dr. Cooper, and with me today I have my constant companion, Clinton Collister.
Constant indeed. Yes, it's good to be back, Cooper. Looking forward to talking about the great W.B. Yeats today.
We got some really good poetry. Yeats is one of my favorite poets. I could read anything by him. It's just, it's all so rich and interesting. And so we've got three poems from his early, middle, and late period, we could say, and each dealing with a different sort of aspect of his oeuvre. And hopefully this will give you, dear listener, a primer to the poetry of Yeats and will inspire in you a great interest in him. I know that Clinton wrote his final poetry term paper on Yeats, the poetry of Yeats. Didn't you, Clinton?
I did. I was in a modern poetry class back at Valpo with Susanna Childress, who's a poet in her own right. She teaches at Hope now. But I wrote about Yeats, and to this day, I stand by that decision, and even though it's been a while, so I don't know if I should trust that younger man. But I love his work, and I think we're going to see why. We have both kind of the magical, mythological side of his poetry. We have the sort of historical and political, and then also the spiritual longing, kind of odd and unusual spiritual longing, but it's all present here. So he really captures the whole of life.
Well, let's begin with one of my favorite poems by Yeats, the one I have memorized. My son also has it memorized, which is not bad for a three-year-old. And here it is. It's the Song of the Wandering Angus. I went out to the hazel wood because a fire was in my head, and cut and peeled a hazel wand, and hooked a berry to a thread. And when white moths were on the wing, and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. When I had laid it on the floor, I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor, and someone called me by my name. It had become a glimmering girl with apple blossom in her hair, who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. Though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands, I will find out where she has gone and kiss her lips and take her hands, and walk among long dappled grass, and pluck, till time and times are done, the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. So this is a quite early poem by Yeats, and it deals with what he is probably best known for, poetically, which is his poems about faerie, dealing with the idea of faerie and the sort of concept of fairies, pixies, the other world.
So often Irish twilight.
Yeah, Irish twilight, right? And this poem is a good example of it because it's a poem about things that happen in between. And that's the thing about fairy. We often think of fairy in the West sort of consumerized as like pixies and Tinkerbell and, you know, magic. And it's kind of simplified and reduced. And it's all very, I don't know, vanilla. But fairy is actually a kind of frightening thing. It is another world, and it lies on top of our world, right? It occupies the same space, but it's different. You can't cross from one to the other. It's like it's out of sync with our reality, and yet it's as real as ours. And the people in fairy can't get to the real world, and the people in the real world can't get into fairy.
I don't know, but Cooper, it also sort of enchants our world, right? So
it does.
In the first stanza, and cut and peel the hazel wand, and then soon thereafter you have this fish that's caught.
But here's the thing, right? The wall between the worlds breaks down
exactly
at moments of transition. Otherwise, right, they're completely separate, which is why it's terrifying. You can get into fairy and never get out, which is what often happens in the famous Irish stories, right? People are carried off to fairy, and that's what will happen. Like when people disappear, they say, oh, the fairies took them, right? They're carried off and they can never get back because they're taken to the fairy realm. But in the moments of twilight, moments between darkness and night, not in the night, but in the moments when night is becoming day or when day is becoming night, that's when the gap between the worlds is weakest. That veil becomes penetrable. And that's what's happening in this poem. We look at the time, right? And the time is when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, right? We're approaching dawn. We're in that early morning. The sun isn't up yet, but the night is fading. And the worlds are, that gap between the worlds is penetrable. And he's able to kind of, he doesn't merely drop his berry into a stream. He drops it into another world, right? It's somehow, because it's a hazel wand, hazel, of course, being the preferred wood for the mystical experience, for being involved in fairy. Hazel is connected to all sorts of Celtic and pagan ideas about this. And it's not merely a rod, it's a hazel wand, right? A wonderful word that means both a staff or a rod, right? Like a fishing rod, but also means like a mystical device. So you see, it's both. Once again, it's transitory.
Right.
And that's what this poem is about. It's about things that are more than one thing, just like twilight is more than just day. It's also night. It's at those moments of intersection or blending when one thing is multiple things. That's where we begin to, you know, get the crossover from the real world and the fairy realm.
And I think that's part of what sparks this lifelong desire in the speaker, right? The fact that he's had this encounter with the natural that is supernatural or supernaturalized. The wand that is both a fishing rod and something magical that gives him access to another
device, right?
Right, right.
So the berry is dropped in the stream and the little silver trout comes out. Silver's a great thing too, right? Because it's not merely the color of a fish, but it's also, you know, a currency. It has value. And he lays it on the floor and blows the fire aflame. And then I love this wonderful, the second two lines of the second stanza, but something rustled on the floor, something. And someone called me by my name. Something becomes someone in the space of a line, right? Something rustled on the floor. It was a fish. And someone called me by my name. Now it's a person in the space. Right there in that happening, in the rustling. That's where the transitory moment is, the poem tells us. It had become a glimmering girl. Not just a girl, but she glimmers with apple blossom in her hair. There's another transitory thing, right? The apple blossom is not permanent. It isn't the tree. It isn't a sprig. It isn't even a leaf. It blooms and fades. Its blooming is progress to fading, right? It's a transitory symbol, just like the sakura cherry blossom is in Japan. They bloom but for a moment. And she's not fixed either. She's not static. The moment she calls the speaker by his name, she runs and fades. She doesn't vanish. It's important that we understand she doesn't vanish. She fades. She goes through a transition, right? She fades through the brightening air, which itself is undergoing a transition. It's all about nothing is static in this poem, I guess is what I'm trying to say. That everything is in transit between two points of stasis. Or that we would think of as stasis, that we think of as day and night as a static thing, right? But this poem is occupied with the points in between fixity and you know, invisibility is fading, right?
What do you think it is about the dawn and the dusk that appeal to this sort of
to the idea of fairy?
Fairy sensibility.
Well, I suppose this would be a question for someone like Dr. Francis Young, who has made a study of Celtic ritual and its connections to Christian theology. I think that probably if we imagine fairy as a world on top of our own or occupying the same space but different, mm-hmm. there's actually a great modern book that does really well with this theory. It's called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Have you read it? It's by Susanna.
I haven't read it, no.
It's quite good, actually. It's very long. And there's a BBC series about it, which is also pretty good. But the book is far better than the series, and the series is good. So read the book. It's written in this sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, 18th century prose, right? So it's kind of like a parody or a satire on 18th
century.
Sounds
right up your alley, Cooper.
It's quite funny. It's really good. It's very, very well written. In any case, the plot of the book is about this. Part of the plot involves this woman who falls in love with one of the protagonists and she's carried off to the realm of fairy. And she has to spend every night there. So when she goes to sleep, she's actually in fairy. She wakes up in fairy and she's there and she's like the prisoner of the fairy king, fairy prince. But she's cursed. so that when she wakes up, she cannot speak about it. It's impossible. And if she tries to speak about it, she only speaks nonsense. Like just, she speaks like newsprint nonsense, like stuff from current events. And because she never sleeps, right? Because she goes to sleep, she instantly wakes up in fairy. She starts to go mad and, you know, eventually tries to kill herself because she's trying to escape. And I think that that right there is kind of how we should imagine it, right? Like the fairy realm in that book is on top of the normal realm. The buildings are still there. The furnishings are still there, but it's weird and bizarre. And none of the people are there. Instead, it's populated by fairy people. And it's horrible, right, in some terrifying way. And
well, if it's horrible, then why is it so alluring?
Right. Well, because it's not – like it isn't really alluring. It's
I don't know.
Fascinating. Well,
look at the last
alluring.
Stanza.
I don't know. Well, the last stanza, he's not trying to get to fairy. He's trying to chase the girl. I think this is important. He's not trying to go to fairy. Mm-hmm. He's trying to look at the girl who he brought from fairy into reality, right, into our world. He caught her. He pulled her out of fairy, just like he pulled the fish out of the stream. In fact, both things happen simultaneously. It's important, right? That pulling the fish out of the stream is the real event. But the fairy event is that he pulled the girl out of fairy with this hazel wand. And so he spent the rest of his life.
You're assuming she could not return to fairy.
Well, he doesn't know that, right? He assumes. Because he says, I will find out where she has gone. He's convinced he will succeed. So he seems to believe that she's still in the real world.
I think you're onto something because he does say the silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun. So he's not going to dawn and dusk to find her. He's going to the day and the night, which is more of a real world sort of setting.
Exactly. That's the thing, right? Now, it's worth noting that also this is all past tense, right? He's been looking for her. He's not going to. I mean, he's going to continue, right? But he says, though I am old with wandering through hollow lands and hilly lands. He's been wandering.
But I will find out where she has gone.
He's still looking, right? He has been looking, and he will continue to look. He's in the middle of his search, right? He's also in a moment of transit. He's not done. He's not at the beginning. He's not at the end. He's in the middle. And he will kiss her lips and take her hands. And where will they walk? Among long dappled grass. They will be in the middle of it. And
one thing that I think is really fascinating about this poem is, on one hand, it's weird, right? It's about this guy fishing, the fairy, the fish transforms into a fairy. He's chasing her for his whole life. He wants to kiss her and hold her, and yet, so that's a very strange setup for a poem, right? But it's also written in a tetrameter, and it's like written in a sort of folk style. You know, just a man going out to the wood, a man going fishing, totally normal sort of behavior, going on hikes through the woods in the hills. So what do you make of that? Like, how does this relate to Yeats' desire at this point in his career as a poet to connect with the Irish people?
Well, this is a common folklore trope. Right. I don't remember the name of it because my knowledge of folklore studies is very limited. But there are certain tropes or set pieces. And one of the set pieces is you catch the thing that actually turns into something else and grants you wishes or entrances the protagonist or something. So this is the one where the protagonist catches an animal and it's actually a person and he falls in love with it and it eludes him, like he chases it. And there's things like that, right? Like the princess and the frog, very similar, right? The golden fish, right, that you catch and it gives you three wishes. Okay. There's a similar sort of arc of all these famous legends and fables and early folklore stories that are connected. So there's part of that. And even, in fact, there's even a thing, I think it's called a ningyu, I can't remember, a pingyu. My Japanese is poor. But it's the basis of the Studio Ghibli movie, the Miyazaki movie, Ponyo. Which is about it's a Japanese legend about a fish that turns into a girl, okay, a goldfish that turns into a girl. So here we have something very similar. So that's part of it, right? It's connected to this, you know, worldwide shared folklore sort of language. The thing that makes it different is the focus on moments of transit. That's really a fairy thing. That's not in the Japanese. It's not in the Arabic. It's really, that's a, a Gaelic, Irish, Celtic sort of notion. The idea of transitory transit between night and day particularly is important. That dusk and twilight are the most important moments, the moments when that link between the two worlds is indeed the weakest, the moment when you can break through between one and the other. And of course, they had an idea that that would happen typically during the equinox, right? I'm sorry, the solstice, right? When one is very long and the other is very short, that somehow weakens the veil between the worlds still further. So that's part of it, right? Maybe.
Right.
The second thing is that the speaker is fascinated with the girl, but he's not fascinated by fairy. And it's not entirely clear that the speaker even understands that she's a fairy. In fact, his pursuit of her seems to suggest that he thinks that she's just an ordinary girl, which seems bizarre, right? Because she was a fish and transformed, not necessarily before his eyes, but, you know, between one glimpse and another.
Right.
So he should be aware, at least, that there's something more than peculiar about her.
There must have been something in her voice, in that glimpse, in...
called me by my name. She knew his name. I think that's important, right?
And that seems important.
The poet doesn't say she merely called me, that she called him by his name and ran. And that's very strange, right? If you wanted someone not to follow you, if you were frightened of them, you wouldn't call them by their name and then run. So clearly the girl seems to have some desire for him to follow her. And we have to wonder how the wandering has... fits into her plan. A part of the story of fairy, of course, is that fairies don't age. The time doesn't pass in fairy. So she's probably still a glimmering girl, but he's become old, right? He's old with wandering.
Mm-hmm.
He's still looking for her.
But he still has the desires of youth. He wants to kiss her lips and take her hands, right? So
and walk.
Fascinating.
Wonderful poem. There was another reading I've heard, which is that this poem is about like the pursuit of an unreachable excellence, right? That the glimmering girl represents some kind of perfection.
Oh, Cooper, back to Excelsior.
Well, listen, there was a Star Trek Enterprise episode.
Oh, no.
Yes, there is. There's a Star Trek Enterprise episode where Captain Archer mentions this poem, and that's his reading of it. He thinks that it's about the pursuit of an unreachable perfection. That's interesting. I think it's probably less complex than what we're talking about, but probably valid. Like, you can read this and certainly read it that way.
That mere glimpse of this magical woman who knows your name is an excellence that you can't find in ordinary women on the street that you actually know well.
It's more than women, I think. I think it's just perfection more generally. Like, this
perfection is more generally. Well, but we have to work with the symbol given, right? Yeah.
There's something alluring about perfection, but it is unreachable. And that suggests, of course, the poem suggests you shouldn't stop trying, although you're old, right? Because you continue to try. And there's always the idea in your mind of what will happen when you achieve excellence, right? Then you will kiss her lips. You will take her hand. You'll walk among the grass.
Yeah.
You'll pluck till – you'll be able to rest in a sense. You'll pluck till time and times are done the apples of the moon and the sun. Of course, you never reach that point. But it's the idea that motivates you, right? Like, if I could achieve perfection, then I could.
I don't know, though. It until times and times are done, I think that more so focuses on aging and mortality, right? There at the end.
Does it?
There's only so many times.
Time and times are
you,
done.
That you see the sun and the moon, right?
Maybe. I don't know. The speaker seems to. He doesn't suggest until his time is done. He says time and times, right? All times. Eternally. Hmm. There'll be eternal rest, right? He'll be able to enjoy that somehow. That achieving perfection is a kind of immortality, which I suppose it would be. I mean, look at the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. That's perfection, and he's immortal. We'll be listening to Mendelssohn in 1,000 years, in 2,000 years, in 5,000 years. Still, people will listen to the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. A sort of immortality is won through such things, or Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, right?
Yeah.
So perhaps there's a certain truth to that.
I just don't. That doesn't seem to be what the speaker's focused on. Some sort of
no, but it's a lesson we might
excellent
draw from the speaker.
Excellent achievement or excellent artwork. It seems like the speaker's trying to find something within the natural or supernatural reality to satisfy his desire, And it doesn't, so I don't think he's turning to himself necessarily for that. It seems like he's looking outward.
Ah, but maybe perfection does lie without. It certainly doesn't necessarily lie within. Certainly not inspirationally. Mendelssohn got his idea from the violin concerto because of inspiration, which came from without. Same thing for the ninth, right?
Sure.
They're not wholly interior things. You have to be able to look out. Otherwise, like, can you think of a work of perfection that was wholly interior? I can't. I can think of important works that are wholly interior, but they're certainly not. Like, imagine the Critique of Pure Reason, right?
Right.
That's a wholly interior work of excellence, but it's not good.
Yeah, I guess I just see the pursuit of the fairy woman as more analogous to the desire to catch the perfect fish than the desire to, I don't know, build the perfect house. Like, it seems like the speaker's in pursuit of something that exists out there, and in this wandering, that's what he's seeking.
I don't know. That's how I find. I don't think it's like building the perfect house, but I think that writing a symphony or achieving a perfection is not totally disanalogous to chasing an elusive and beautiful woman who knows your name and who is connected to you through that berry on a stream. You brought it into the world, but now it escapes you. It eludes you. Can you find it? Spend your whole life looking for it. With the expectation you will achieve it and the imaginings of what will come when you do. But whether or not you do is a different matter.
Could be. It's an interesting reading.
Yeah, like I said, it's not a totally invalid reading. It's an interesting one. I'm willing to entertain it. So thank you to Captain Archer for submitting that to us. We now move on.
Yes.
We have something quite different, don't we, Clinton?
Extremely different, but also prominent in Yeats' life and career.
So setting aside fairy, we'll attend to only one of the realms. In Easter 1916, I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces, from counter or desk among gray 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head or polite, meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite, meaningless words, and thought before I had done of a mocking tale or jibe to please a companion around the fire at the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn, all changed, changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. That woman's days were spent in ignorant goodwill, her nights in argument until her voice grew shrill. What voice more sweet than hers, when, young and beautiful, she rode to harriers? This man had kept a school and rode our winged horse. This other, his helper and friend, was coming into his force. He might have won fame in the end, so sensitive his nature seemed, so daring and sweet his thought. The other man I had dreamed, a drunken, vainglorious lout. He had done most bitter wrong to some who are near my heart. Yet I number him in the song. He, too, has resigned his part in the casual comedy. He, too, has been changed in his turn, transformed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. Hearts with one purpose alone, through summer and winter seem, enchanted to a stone to trouble the living stream. The horse that comes from the road, the rider, the birds that range from cloud to tumbling cloud, minute by minute they change. A shadow of cloud on the stream changes minute by minute. A horse hoof slides on the brim, and a horse plashes within it. The long-legged moorhens dive, and hens to moorcocks call. Minute by minute they live, the stones in the midst of all. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. Oh, when may it suffice? That is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name, as a mother names her child, when sleep at last has come on limbs that had run wild. What is it but nightfall? No, no, not night, but death. Was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. We know their dreams enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what if excess of love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse. MacDonagh and MacBride, and Connolly and Pearse, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed, changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born. Okay, Clinton, this is your selection,
sir.
So have at it.
Well, I do think it's a particularly important poem if we want to understand Yeats. So he early on in his career, he was more influenced by English poetry and culture, and particularly he was influenced by Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen. He was influenced by Shelley, and he wrote about India and the Far East, and he wrote in a sort of dreamlike way. And then he came to the conclusion through the sort of Irish nationalism and the Celtic Renaissance that was happening that the best thing for him to do as an Irish man was to write about Ireland, right? And to support his native people and their folk traditions and customs and culture and language. And he gave himself over to that. And he, you know, was involved with starting an Irish theater. He fell in love with an controversial Irish nationalist named Maud Gonne. He looked at her as his Helen, he says in some poems. He also compared her to Beatrice and looked to her as a sort of ideal of perfection that he was in pursuit of for many, many years. And in this poem, we see the Easter 1916 uprising, wherein a number of Irish nationalists, you know, many of them artists and intellectuals, decided to try to revolt militarily against the British Empire. And it goes horribly awry, right? They don't have the manpower or the weaponry to pull this off. And Yeats, as you can see throughout this poem, he knew them. He himself was a nationalist, but he was focused more so on culture. He was not for violent revolt. And so he wasn't quite on the same page as these men. But, you know, Patrick Pearse was a schoolmaster who was responsible, at least in part, for a sort of revival that happened with the Irish language. And so these were significant people, and Yeats sees some promise in them as he kind of recounts the major figures in this particular uprising. But I think it's a good poem to think about if you want to understand the broader scope of his career. So he does have these sort of dreamlike fairy poems, but he also has these poems that are deeply invested in historical events of his own lifetime.
So the Easter Rising is a major event in Irish literature, even, right? It's represented here in this poem by Yeats, and the names he mentions at the end of the poem, MacDonagh, MacBride, Connolly, and Pearse, these are some of the Irishmen who were executed in the wake of the Easter Rising. Took place in early May. The Easter Rising took place at the end of April 1916. It was crushed by the British, and many of the people who were executed were not even really involved in any way. And some of the names here are people who weren't properly involved. Pearse was just a stenographer, right? A secretary, a note taker, an attaché. MacBride wasn't even aware of the rising. So some of these people who were killed were effectively innocent. There was very little evidence presented, and they were simply executed for many of them for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or for simply being Irish at the wrong time. And so he talks about the murmuring of names, right? This is an attempt to memorialize people so that they won't be forgotten, because many of them were innocent, right? They were caught up in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is unfortunately a sort of a continuing thread through British history of innocent people who are killed because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. We think of Peterloo, right, which occurred about half a century earlier in the 19th century, where all these civilians turned out and, you know, they were unarmed, and the military was sort of trigger happy. The militia was called out to sort of keep an eye on things, and they just went in with sabers and cut a bunch of women and children and, you know, peaceful protesters to ribbons. So this is, I think, a wonderful poem in that it reminds us of two things. First, it reminds us of the Easter Rising, which it can be kind of easy to forget today now that the Troubles are effectively over, right? There is an independent Ireland, It's not unified, but it is independent. And it's easy to forget that these people died for that, that they sought to create an independent Ireland 100 years before that was realized, nearly. I wonder, reading this, if we can see, I think, a Yeatsian conviction that God is on the side of the Irish, right? In the final of these four stanzas, he mentions that it is heaven's part, our part, to murmur name upon name. Heaven itself murmurs the names of these dead Irishmen who were executed by the British for their participation, in quotes, right, in the Easter Rising, suggesting that God is on the side of the Irish Republicans.
And Yeats kind of had a complicated relationship to some of the other Irish Republicans, given that he was raised in a Protestant family and he still considered himself something of a Protestant agnostic. And he also descended from, more English stock, at least in part. And so, he definitely was fully in favor of the Irish nationalist cause, but it's, he comes from a complex perspective, I guess I'm trying to say. And I think that comes through numerous times in the poem. He refers to it, to this event, as a terrible beauty being born. And so what do you think of that phrase, terrible beauty?
Well, there's a certain, this led to the real troubles, right? After the rising, the British attitude in the 19th century and early 20th century towards what they perceived to be rebellions of any sort was massive and disproportionate retaliation, right? During the Sepoy Rebellion in India, they lined up sepoys in front of cannons and blew them apart, which is now done by Kim Jong-il, right, and the North Koreans. That's a tyrannical, barbaric thing, and the British were doing it in the mid-19th century. And by the early 20th century, although they were done with that sort of thing, they had no problems rounding up lots and lots of people and executing them, many of them with virtually no connection, including sometimes children, right? A number of things followed this, and the consequence of it was the rise of Sinn Féin, right? And the troubles. It led to a century of unremitting warfare, effectively, between the IRA, Sinn Féin, the UK government, so on and so forth. And it could all have been avoided in the late 19th century if people had listened to Gladstone and approved the Irish Home Rule Bill. But, that wasn't done, and it took 100 years to fix it. So certainly there is a sense in which, looking at this, you can think that there's a terrible beauty to it, right? That you're making martyrs, effectively, for the cause. And if Yeats had lived to the 1990s, he probably would have been greatly pleased, I think, by Irish independence. But I don't know if he would think it was all worth it. He died in 1939, so he never got to see an independent Ireland. But certainly you might imagine in the 20s, right, with the Irish desperately trying to get what seemed to be now at that point an impossible freedom, you could imagine seeing the deaths of these innocent people as having a terrible beauty, right? Because it's terrible that innocent people should die, but it's also going to galvanize the Irish and make what was a fairly marginal cause sort of universal, right? There's a terrible mm-hmm. beauty to martyrs, isn't there, Clinton?
Yeah, and it's powerful, right? A lot of people kind of thought that the Irish nationalist cause was waning leading up to this point, and this really galvanized the Irish against British imperialism and kind of spread the sort of ideas and practices these people believed in who died in these executions.
I think of, is it Charles Stuart Parnell? Yeah. He was the Irish nationalist in the late 19th century, 1880s and 1890s, who also was championing alongside Gladstone, the Home Rule Bill. And Parnell had been kind of under the table, involved in some of the more violent Irish Republican movements. And then just as they thought they were making some progress, one of these violent movements attacked and killed a senior British civil servant in the street and murdered him. And that senior civil servant turned out to be like the nephew of Gladstone or something, the man who was the British, you know, politician who was trying to give Ireland home rule. And Parnell basically went and, you know, offered himself up for, you know, in exchange for this crime and said, you know, I'll take responsibility for it. And, you know, it's done nothing to advance our cause that we're trying to achieve. And it's terrible. And I'm so sorry that this was done to your family. And Gladstone, instead of kicking Parnell to the curb, accepted the apology and worked even harder to achieve home rule for Ireland. Right. Like right. That there's a sense here that every time Ireland's independence seems to wane, one of these violent moments comes along and kind of reignites the fire of people to do it. So that it's terrible, yes. But if you believe that an independent Ireland is a good thing, then yeah, there is something beautiful about it. That's for the cause, right? It's mm-hmm. for the cause.
I think his form in this poem is fascinating. So he has – it's set in April, and I think there are four stanzas which lines up with that. And then it's written, even though it's about this grand event in Irish history, right? The martyrdom of these men or the sacrifice of these men, this rebellion against the odds, it's in a very simple trimeter.
Yeah.
And also there's a real matter of fact, everyday sort of quality to it. So it's not like the charge of the Light Brigade. He's just describing himself kind of walking down the street and remembering seeing these men on the same roads he used to walk and not always speaking well of them, you know, poking a little fun at their earnestness and their exuberance at times even. But he is also thinks that they should be honored.
There's something about this, something very vaguely song-like, right? Or like chant-like mm-hmm. that you could sit around a table because it's got the tetrameter, trimeter, the back right. and forth, 4-3, 4-3, which sets it up to almost be the sort of thing that you would kind of sing together around a table, which might be just the sort of thing for a poem of this sort, a way of murmuring the names, right? Of remembering what has come and what has happened. All right, one more. Late Yeats, right? Yeah, 1928,
yes.
I think. Sailing to Byzantium from the Tower, collection published in 1928. Quite different in nature from the preceding two. So, as I said, I think Yeats died in 39. So, he's got about, this is near the end of his life, last decade of his life or so. And it's got some famous lines. Here they are. That is no country for old men, the young, in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. The salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas. Fish, flesh, or fowl commend all summer long whatever is begotten, born, and dies. Caught in that sensual music all neglect, monuments of unaging intellect. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. Nor is there singing school but studying monuments of its own magnificence, and therefore I have sailed the seas and come to the holy city of Byzantium. O sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall, come from the holy fire, pern in a gyre, and be the singing masters of my soul. Consume my heart away, sick with desire, and fastened to a dying animal. It knows not what it is, and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make, of hammered gold and gold enameling, to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium, of what is past, or passing, or to come. What a great poem. And that final stanza reminds me so much of early Yeats, right? That he'll pluck till time and times are done. The silver apples of the moon, the golden apples of the sun, right? There's a sort of eternality with which the poem ends. To keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing of what is past, or passing, or to come. So, Clinton, you say that this poem is about spiritual longing.
Well, I mean, I think that's definitely one aspect of it. But I also think it's really interesting that that you pair it with that first poem, because in the first poem, the Song of the Wandering Aengus, he's a young man thinking about a man at the end of his life, right, looking back. And
yeah,
here,
an old man thinking about what happened in his youth and what he's going to. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's kind of an interesting
wandering. Yes.
Parallel. What do you think has changed in his perspective between the two poems, or in the speaker's perspective between the two poems?
Well, certainly for Yeats, he is now an older.
Well, yeah. On the surface, obviously, he's now actually old and has that experience. But I mean, in the poems, what do you think?
Well, let's see. It's hard to say because the first poem isn't really about, doesn't strike me as being about age as such. This poem certainly is. This poem is about the importance of youth, the value of youth, but also its fleetingness, right? The things he mentions in stanza one, the things about youth are youth and death, right? That are cooked together in some way. Those dying generations, he says in line three. And then what does he describe? He describes the salmon falls, right?
Whatever is begotten, born, and dies.
Exactly. The mackerel-crowded seas, right, which are fished. Fish, flesh, or fowl commend all summer long. Whatever is begotten, born, and dies. That which lives and dies. Caught in that sensual music, all neglect monuments of unaging intellect. Unaging intellect. Monuments of unaging intellect. That there's a wisdom that transcends time. There's a wisdom that is outside of time, right? It doesn't age. It is eternal. And this is one of the things that I think this is a sort of thread that runs through Yeats, the idea of the eternal. We even see it in Easter 1916, right? That the point is to murmur their names forever, to remember them forever, to commend them to eternity. That's heaven's part and our part, the speaker says in that poem. And heaven, of course, being an eternal place, will ensure that it's done eternally. We see it in the Song of the Wandering Aengus, where the Aengus has been and continues to search for the Glimmering Girl despite his age, right? And the Glimmering Girl seems timeless. We don't ever see her for a moment, and yet she remains timeless. She's fixed in that moment in the mind of the reader. And here in this poem, we have the timelessness of the intellect. We have the timelessness of the end of the poem, when the speaker, who is, once he's out of nature, dead or something else, perhaps? He will not take his bodily form from any natural thing. He'll have a choice. Like the spirit, taken out of nature, can assume the shape it desires. This sounds like the angels to me, right? Which are they're able to assume whatever desire, whatever appearance they like. Remember, Lucifer in the garden chooses to be the snake. He chooses to appear this way. Only later is he kind of cursed with a snake-like body. When he returns to Pandemonium and relates what he has done to Eve and Adam. But that was his choice initially. So here there's idea that the spirit can choose its appearance.
And to connect to your point about the importance of eternal life or eternity at the end of section three, right?
Yeah, the artifice of eternity.
Yeah.
It's interesting that eternity is an artifice here, right? Which is a sort of, there's a sort of dual meaning to that. I'd have to have a look at etymologically how it was used in the 20s. But artifice nowadays can mean something that is fake, right? Facade-like, right? That we say if it is done with artifice, that it's fake, right? It's not real. It's contrived. That's the word we're looking for, I think. It's contrived. But artifice is also that which is done with great skill, right? This is much earlier understanding of the word, like in the 16th, 17th century, if you were to describe something as artificial, that would be high praise, right? That it was done with the skill of an artificer, a master craftsman. So,
and that contrasts with the use of the term where you have natural set against artificial,
yeah,
right? What derives in nature versus what derives from the hands of man. And so I like that he uses that term there, because it kind of gestures toward his own wonder at eternity, right? It can be read either way.
Yes, there is a sort of a sort of heretical trimming here, right?
Right.
Gnosticism, right?
He was known to to speak some heresy every now and then. Yeah, that's so, for sure.
In stanza three, right? Consume my heart away. Sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal. It knows not what it is. And gather me into the artifice of eternity. Consume my heart away and gather me into the artifice of eternity. Why? Why consume my heart? Because my heart, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, doesn't know what it is. Right? That somehow matter is the problem in this poem. Matter is decayed. Matter is evil. That's the Gnostics, right? That's Gnosticism, one of the great heresies. And we get that sense in stanzas three and four, that the physical is holding back the spiritual. That's it, and the speaker knows it in stanza four. That's why he says, once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing. Right? That he'll have a bodily form, but it won't be material. It won't be some sort of created natural thing. It'll be artificial. It'll be a form such as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling. It won't be an animal. It won't be some crawling, creeping, walking thing. It'll be
something that decays and dies, right?
Exactly, right? Like that's the problem with the corporeal flesh, right? It must decay. It must die. It must turn to dust. He will choose the artificial but eternal, the form such as Grecian goldsmiths make, gold which lasts forever, right? So here it seems to be that the flesh is a problem for the speaker. But artifice is not. Artifice is good. The artifice of eternity, that which is created and endures forever, like a pyramid, right? You can imagine the speaker looking
or at a poem.
Yeah, or a poem. But I think he's fascinated by the physical, right?
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be this poem is replete with symbols of creation, especially with symbols of like sort of goldsmithing, right? That there's a holy fire. Consume my heart away, like right, render it, purify it, as in a crucible. That the poem seems to be about the purification of the soul by the destruction of the body. That's
but also theoretical. About being made new by an artificer, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, God in a sense is the master artificer, right? He's the artificer of creation. But
and so you have to wonder: is he thinking about God here, or is he more so focused on his own artistry?
Like the sense, right? Stanza three, sages standing in God's holy fire.
Right.
That the sages.
So God's definitely there.
They're in, like, why are they sages, right? Because they are purified in the crucible of God, right? That they're standing in the fire. The impurities are being burned away.
As Eliot says, by fire or fire, right?
Yeah. Sages standing in God's holy fire, as in the gold mosaic of a wall. See, immediately they're connected to the visual physical, right? As in a gold mosaic of a wall. It's about
he's extremely interested in gold here.
Yeah, well, gold, yeah. Gold is cleansed of impurity, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's worked by artificers, and it's made into. It doesn't tarnish, it doesn't rust. It endures, right? It lasts forever. And it's wrought into things of beauty. That's its purpose. It's not made into ugly things. It's made into beautiful things.
Well, it's interesting, too, because you have the speaker being remade in gold, right? Being purified. But then you also have the speaker continuing as an artificer, as an artist, or set upon a golden bough to sing, right? So even at the end, this seems to be the speaker's purpose.
Yeah, he will be put upon a golden bough, as it made into like a little golden bird, right? To be placed on a golden bough and sing of what is past or passing or to come. I think gold is important in this poem. Gold is like it's a sort of mineral equivalent of human existence, because gold is inside of ore, right? And the ore is what we see. We take it out of the ground. It's this big, dirty rock with little flecks of gold. And we say, oh, look how ugly that is. What do we have to do to it? We have to burn it away. We have to smash it. We have to heat it. We have to burn away the impurity until only the gold is left.
So do you think out of the human body is like the ore in this poem?
Once out of nature, right? We have to take gold out of nature. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing. That's the natural state of gold, not beautiful metalworking. right? Locked inside of dingy ore deep in the rock. That's the natural thing. But once out of nature, we shall hammer it. We shall make it into mosaics. We shall fashion it into birds, crowns, rings, things of beauty, things that would keep a drowsy emperor awake. So beautiful would they be. Things that would sing to the great and the good of the past, the present, and the future. That's why I say this is a heretical poem. It's Gnostic, right? This Gnostic poem about the fallenness of creation natural, right? The human body or the human bodily existence is evil. But of course, God created human bodily existence, and God does not create evil. So that's
why he created and called it good too.
He created and called it good. That's why it's an heresy, right?
Yeah.
But this was the Gnostics that they incorporated this belief. They brought it over that the soul is good and it's trapped in the evil, wicked body. Only when it's freed from the body can it truly achieve its ultimate purpose.
I wonder what the connections are between the sort of theosophy and Eastern religion and spiritualism that he played around with throughout his life and Gnosticism.
He's going to Byzantium.
Well, but which is the second Rome, though, so that's kind of complicated that he's still attracted to a Christian city.
Center. Yeah, he's not going to Istanbul. He's going to Byzantium.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. It's an interesting
thing. Complicated.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Cooper. I think that's it for Yeats this week, but we're definitely coming back to him someday.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's so much. I will happily read Yeats any day, anytime. I will read Yeats on a plane. I will read Yeats with my mane, etc. Right? Give me more Yeats. I do
for
like
sure.
Yeats. I do. So next week, how about we've had a request for some prose.
Really?
We have.
Who requested? What do they want?
So a reader who mentioned the podcast. Let me pull it up here as I replied to them with the official podcast. And I said, we will talk about it. Let me see. Here it is. So David, thank you, David. Mythic Mind asked, what are your favorite literature-oriented podcasts? And David replied, Crit Readings is good, but I believe it's only poetry. Forgive my ignorance. I have 1,000 podcasts to try to hear. We were the only one he recommended. So first, David, thank you. You're awesome. That's brilliant. And then he said, he believes it's only poetry. And I corrected him. I went on the critical readings. I said, we do have plans to cover prose work in upcoming episodes. Expect them in the summer. So the original point of this podcast was not to be only poetry, although we have spent quite a bit of time on poetry and deservedly so, but also to
both of us are quite smitten with poetry, so yeah. It's hard to turn away.
But I do enjoy prose, right?
Yes,
there's
sure,
quite a few
of course.
Prose works. So I think we will begin thinking about this, and maybe this summer we will cover a prose work or two. We have to think about it because there are a lot of important prose works and they take a little longer and then the discussion of them has to be done a little bit differently because you can't read the whole thing and then talk about it.
Certainly not.
Yeah, they're not quite.
Well, but I mean, when we were covering Paradise Lost, we didn't
read everything. Made some selections, right? So maybe we will do that. The whole point of this podcast was to pick important canonical works that everyone should have read and try to correct for a public school system that doesn't teach them very effectively or in many cases at all. Having
it's
run into
spotty
many,
nowadays. Informational reading is on the rise, and oftentimes that translates into reading sort of transient news as literature.
Write editorials about them, which is not valuable in any shape. But in any case, I know that over the years of teaching my students, when they come in and, I'll say, blah, 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 as Milton says in such and such, or in Paradise Lost where it's written that, and Shakespeare says that, and like my students kind of, their eyes glaze over, and I say, do you not, Milton, John Milton, Paradise Lost? And a few hands. Okay. Have you read it? Well, no, I've heard of it. You haven't read? Some of them don't even know who he is, right? Okay, so to correct that, and my students, they don't think I'm some kook. They feel bad, not ashamed, but angry that they've been denied, right?
I mean, it's really like somebody has squandered their inheritance.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Like you have this great, enormous culture as an English speaker.
All
hundreds
of these
of years.
Beautiful treasures.
And, instead of being taught them, you're reading like articles from the Huffington Post and Confessions of a Shopaholic and stuff. And so they feel very hard done by. And so, you know, this is a way of remedying that. So if that's happened to you, you can listen to this podcast and you can try to like, no, see, maybe they didn't teach you Yeats in school, but this episode of the podcast will give you a primer into Yeats. So now you can go pick up a book of Yeats and read some Yeats on your own, even beyond what we've read here, and begin to apply these techniques yourself. And so, you know, I can't teach you a 15-week semester on Yeats, but we can spend like a class period talking about Yeats, and you can listen and you can participate, and on we go.
Yes, so, yeah. And prose, and I think you can see that these poems are alive, right? They're not just some sort of archaeological discovery for us in which they don't mean anything to our lives or to your life, I think there's a vitality, and I hope that comes through in the podcast.
Absolutely. And it's true of prose too. Like, there are important canonical prose works that people have not always read. You know, some of them still make it through. Like, we generally all read the Odyssey in ninth grade. We all generally read Romeo and Juliet in high school. They're good. That's all to the good. I say generally because even these things are now in doubt. But, you know, how many of us are reading Dickens? Some of us read A Trail of Two Cities, but not all of us. So we'll think about it. We'll see what prose works would suit. And then look forward to that this summer. We'll do at least one or two prose works. Okay. So thank you for your comments. We appreciate it. And if you'd like us to cover a particular poet, or if you have a particular prose work in mind, please do leave a comment and let us know. Either at academician.com, you can comment on this podcast. You don't have to register. You can just type a comment. Or you can send us a tweet at @CritReadings on Twitter. All right. Well, next week, Clinton, we had a request for Hardy. So how about a little Thomas Hardy next week?
I'm up for it, for sure.
Thomas Hardy. We'll be back next week with some poetry by Thomas Hardy. But until then, from all of us here at Critical Readings, go well.
Take care.